Law 27. Play on people's need to believe to create a cult-like following. Judgment. People have an overwhelming desire to believe in something. Become the focal point of such desire by offering them a cause, a new faith to follow. Keep your words vague but full of promise. Emphasize enthusiasm over rationality and clear thinking. Give your new disciples rituals to perform. Ask them to make sacrifices on your behalf. In the absence of organized religion and grand causes, your new belief system will bring you untold power. The Science of Charlatanism, or How to Create a Cult in 5 Easy Steps. In searching, as you must, for the methods that will gain you the most power for the least effort, you will find the creation of a cult-like following one of the most effective. Having a large following opens up all sorts of possibilities for deception. Not only will your followers worship you, they will defend you from your enemies and will voluntarily take on the work of enticing others to join your fledgling cult. This kind of power will lift you to another realm. You will no longer have to struggle or use subterfuge to enforce your will. You are adored and can do no wrong. You might think it's a gargantuan task to create such a following, but in fact, it is fairly simple. As humans, we have a desperate need to believe in something, anything. This makes us eminently gullible. We simply cannot endure long periods of doubt or of the emptiness that comes from a lack of something to believe in. Dangle in front of us some new cause, elixir, get-rich-quick scheme, or the latest technological trend or art movement, and we leap from the water as one to take the bait. Look at history. The chronicles of the new trends and cults that have made a mass following for themselves could fill a library. After a few centuries, a few decades, a few years, a few months, they generally look ridiculous. But at the time, they seemed so attractive, so transcendental, so divine. Always in a rush to believe in something, we will manufacture saints and faiths out of nothing. Do not let this gullibility go to waste. Make yourself the object of worship. Make people form a cult around you. The great European charlatans of the 16th and 17th centuries mastered the art of cult making. They lived, as we do now, in a time of transformation. Organized religion was on the wane, science on the rise. People were desperate to rally around a new cause or faith. The charlatans had begun by peddling health elixirs and alchemic shortcuts to wealth. Moving quickly from town to town, they originally focused on small groups, until, by accident, they stumbled on a truth of human nature. The larger the group they gathered around themselves, the easier it was to deceive. The charlatan would station himself on a high wooden platform, hence the term mountebank, and crowds would swarm around him. In a group setting, people were more emotional, less able to reason. Had the charlatan spoken to them individually, they might have found him ridiculous. But lost in a crowd, they got caught up in a communal mood of rapt attention. It became impossible for them to find the distance to be skeptical. Any deficiencies in the charlatan's ideas were hidden by the zeal of the mass. Passion and enthusiasm swept through the crowd like a contagion, and they reacted violently to anyone who dared to spread a seed of doubt. Both consciously studying this dynamic over decades of experiment and spontaneously adapting to these situations as they happened, the charlatans perfected the science of attracting and holding a crowd, molding the crowd into followers and the followers into a cult. The gimmicks of the charlatans may seem quaint today, but there are thousands of charlatans among us still, using the same tried and true methods their predecessors refined centuries ago, only changing the names of their elixirs and modernizing the look of their cults. We find these latter-day charlatans in all arenas of life: business, fashion, politics, art. Many of them, perhaps, are following in the charlatan tradition without having any knowledge of its history. But you can be more systematic and deliberate. Simply follow the 5 steps of cult making that our charlatan ancestors perfected over the years. Step 1. Keep it vague. Keep it simple. To create a cult, you must first attract attention. This you should do not through actions, which are too clear and readable, but through words, which are hazy and deceptive. Your initial speeches, conversations, and interviews must include 2 elements. On the one hand, the promise of something great and transformative, and on the other, a total vagueness. This combination will stimulate all kinds of hazy dreams in your listeners, who will make their own connections and see what they want to see. As a corollary to its vagueness, your appeal should also be simple. Most people's problems have complex causes: deep-rooted neurosis, interconnected social factors, roots that go way back in time and are exceedingly hard to unravel. Few, however, have the patience to deal with this. Most people want to hear that a simple solution will cure their problems. The ability to offer this kind of solution will give you great power and build you a following. Step 2. Emphasize the visual and the sensual over the intellectual. Once people have begun to gather around you, 2 dangers will present themselves: boredom and skepticism. Boredom will make people go elsewhere. Skepticism will allow them the distance to think rationally about whatever it is you are offering, blowing away the mist you have artfully created and revealing your ideas for what they are. You need to amuse the bored, then ward off the cynics. The best way to do this is through theater or other devices of its kind. Surround yourself with luxury, dazzle your followers with visual splendor, fill their eyes with spectacle. Not only will this keep them from seeing the ridiculousness of your ideas, the holes in your belief system, it will also attract more attention, more followers. Appeal to all the senses. Use incense for scent, soothing music for hearing, colorful charts and graphs for the eye. You might even tickle the mind, perhaps by using new technological gadgets to give your cult a pseudo-scientific veneer, as long as you do not make anyone really think. Use the exotic, distant cultures, strange customs to create theatrical effects and to make the most banal and ordinary affairs seem signs of something extraordinary. Step 3. Borrow the forms of organized religion to structure the group. Your cult-like following is growing. It is time to organize it. Find a way, both elevating and comforting. Organized religions have long held unquestioned authority for large numbers of people, and continue to do so in our supposedly secular age. And even if the religion itself has faded some, its forms will resonate with power. The lofty and holy associations of organized religion can be endlessly exploited. Create rituals for your followers. Organize them into a hierarchy, ranking them in grades of sanctity and giving them names and titles that resound with religious overtones. Ask them for sacrifices that will fill your coffers and increase your power. To emphasize your gathering's quasi-religious nature, talk and act like a prophet. You are not a dictator. After all, you are a priest, a guru, a sage, a shaman, or any other word that hides your real power in the mist of religion. Step 4. Disguise your source of income. Your group has grown, and you have structured it in a church-like form. Your coffers are beginning to fill with your followers' money. You must never be seen as hungry for money and the power it brings. It is at this moment that you must disguise the source of your income. Your followers want to believe that if they follow you, all sorts of good things will fall into their lap. By surrounding yourself with luxury, you become living proof of the soundness of your belief system. Never reveal that your wealth actually comes from your followers' pockets. Instead, make it seem to come from the truth of your methods. Followers will copy your each and every move in the belief that it will bring them the same results, and their imitative enthusiasm will blind them to the charlatan nature of your wealth. Step 5. Set up an us versus them dynamic. The group is now large and thriving, a magnet attracting more and more particles. If you are not careful, though, inertia will set in and time and boredom will demagnetize the group. To keep your followers united, you must now do what all religions and belief systems have done: create an us versus them dynamic. First, make sure your followers believe they are part of an exclusive club, unified by a bond of common goals. Then, to strengthen this bond, manufacture the notion of a devious enemy out to ruin you. There is a force of non-believers that will do anything to stop you. Any outsider who tries to reveal the charlatan nature of your belief system can now be described as a member of this devious force. If you have no enemies, invent one. Given a straw man to react against, your followers will tighten and cohere. They have your cause to believe in and infidels to destroy. Observance of the law. In the year 1653, a 27-year-old Milan man named Francesco Giuseppe Borri claimed to have had a vision. He went around town telling one and all that the Archangel Michael had appeared to him and announced that he had been chosen to be the Capitano Generale of the army of the new Pope, an army that would seize and revitalize the world. The Archangel had further revealed that Borri now had the power to see people's souls and that he would soon discover the Philosopher's Stone, a long-sought-after substance that could change base metals into gold. Friends and acquaintances who heard Borri explain the vision and who witnessed the change that had come over him were impressed, for Borri had previously devoted himself to a life of wine, women, and gambling. Now he gave all that up, plunging himself into the study of alchemy and talking only of mysticism and the occult. The transformation was so sudden and miraculous, and Borri's words were so filled with enthusiasm that he began to create a following. Unfortunately, the Italian Inquisition began to notice him as well. They prosecuted anyone who delved into the occult. So he left Italy and began to wander Europe, from Austria to Holland, telling one and all that, "To those who follow me, all joy shall be granted." Wherever Borri stayed, he attracted followers. His method was simple. He spoke of his vision, which had grown more and more elaborate, and offered to look into the soul of anyone who believed him, and they were many. Seemingly in a trance, he would stare at this new follower for several minutes, then claim to have seen the person's soul, degree of enlightenment, and potential for spiritual greatness. If what he saw showed promise, he would add the person to his growing order of disciples, an honor indeed. The cult had 6 degrees into which the disciples were assigned according to what Borri had glimpsed in their souls. With work and total devotion to the cult, they could graduate to a higher degree. Borri, whom they called His Excellency and Universal Doctor, demanded from them the strictest vows of poverty. All the goods and monies they possessed had to be turned over to him, but they did not mind handing over their property, for Borri had told them, "I shall soon bring my chemical studies to a happy conclusion by the discovery of the Philosopher's Stone, and by this means we shall all have as much gold as we desire." Given his growing wealth, Bori began to change his style of living, renting the most splendid apartment in the city into which he had temporarily settled. He would furnish it with fabulous furniture and accessories, which he had begun to collect. He would drive through the city in a coach studded with jewels, with six magnificent black horses at its head. He never stayed too long in one place, and when he disappeared, saying he had more souls to gather into his flock, his reputation only grew in his absence. He became famous, although, in fact, he had never done a single concrete thing. From all over Europe, the blind, the crippled, and the desperate came to visit Bori, for word had spread that he had healing powers. He asked no fee for his services, which only made him seem more marvelous, and indeed some claimed that in this or that city he had performed a miracle cure. By only hinting at his accomplishments, he encouraged people's imaginations to blow them up to fantastic proportions. His wealth, for example, actually came from the vast sums he was collecting from his increasingly select group of rich disciples. Yet it was presumed that he had, in fact, perfected the philosopher's stone. The church continued to pursue him, denouncing him for heresy and witchcraft, and Bori's response to these charges was a dignified silence. This only enhanced his reputation and made his followers more passionate. Only the great are persecuted, after all. How many understood Jesus Christ in his own time? Bori did not have to say a word. His followers now called the Pope the Antichrist. And so Bori's power grew and grew, until one day he left the city of Amsterdam, where he had settled for a while, absconding with huge sums of borrowed money and diamonds that had been entrusted to him. He claimed to be able to remove the flaws from diamonds through the power of his gifted mind. Now he was on the run. The Inquisition eventually caught up with him, and for the last 20 years of his life, he was imprisoned in Rome. But so great was the belief in his occult powers that to his dying day, he was visited by wealthy believers, including Queen Christina of Sweden. Supplying him with money and materials, these visitors allowed him to continue his search for the elusive philosopher's stone. Interpretation. Before he formed his cult, Bori seems to have stumbled on a critical discovery. Tiring of his life of debauchery, he had decided to give it up and to devote himself to the occult, a genuine interest of his. He must have noticed, however, that when he alluded to a mystical experience, rather than physical exhaustion, as the source of his conversion, people of all classes wanted to hear more. Realizing the power he could gain by ascribing the change to something external and mysterious, he went further with his manufactured visions. The grander the vision, and the more sacrifices he asked for, the more appealing and believable his story seemed to become. Remember, people are not interested in the truth about change. They do not want to hear that it has come from hard work or from anything as banal as exhaustion, boredom, or depression. They are dying to believe in something romantic, otherworldly. They want to hear of angels and out-of-body experiences. Indulge them. Hint at the mystical source of some personal change. Wrap it in ethereal colors, and a cult-like following will form around you. Adapt to people's needs. The Messiah must mirror the desires of his followers, and always aim high. The bigger and bolder your illusion, the better.